This is the Sector Podcast with me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome to the show, everybody. The Sector Podcast, of course, focusing on the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. As I mentioned, broadcasting here on CITR. You can also hear us live streaming at CITR.ca, and of course, via the podcast, wherever, whenever, as the technology goes. Well, listeners from last week may recall that there was a bit of an issue with last week's show. Apparently, there was a power failure over at CITR at the station. Now, the result of that was there was no Sector Podcast that was broadcasted. You couldn't even listen on the radio. It was, dead silence. There was no live streaming. Unfortunately, though, the podcast was saved, so you can go online and download the podcast. And I suggest you do that because it was a great episode. You can find it at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com and take a listen. Lots to discuss on today's show, of course. Big news that's going on in the social justice world. And of course, the biggest being the rioting that's going on in Ferguson right now. Ferguson, of course, being in Missouri, U.S., just near the city of St. Louis. And the upset, of course, being on the recent decision by a grand jury to not do an indictment of the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown. The police officer in question was Darren Wilson, and Wilson is the 28-year-old white Ferguson police officer who shot him. And during the grand jury decision, they heard testimony from Wilson about the event and the shooting in question, and ultimately decided that there was no reason to proceed with a indictment. Or more accurately, what they're saying, of course, is that there is simply not enough evidence to indicate that there is a point to go to trial. So the confusion about this, of course, is that, well, the grand jury did not find Darren Wilson innocent or guilty. They determined that there simply wasn't enough to this incident to even warrant a trial to determine if Darren Wilson was guilty or innocent of murder. So even if you believe that he acted correctly and within his jurisdiction, you're not even going to get a chance to see any kind of confirmation of that in a court of law, because the grand jury has basically decided that there are no criminal charges in relation to the incident. You know, and obviously you can look at the testimony, you can look at the details of the decision that has been released, and you can also, you know, look at the historical context that goes into this, and it does leave a pretty big hanging question of, really, there was no reason to take this trial? There is absolutely nothing here that warranted a closer look with scrutiny and careful deliberations? Really? Now, the resulting fallout, the rioting, obviously has caused a lot of discussion and a lot of talking points that's going through a lot of different media right now. I think what's interesting, of course, is not only the altercation itself, the decision by the grand jury, which we could devote an entire show to, you know, deconstructing and examining it from the different contexts, the race context, as well as the history that has gone into decisions like this that has created a lot of the frustration. And that is the sort of callous disregard that black lives, especially at the hands of white police officers, has had in American history. It seems like there is a very clear pattern of victimization that police officers have almost untouchable abilities when it comes to dealing with black people in America. And we've seen, obviously, so many examples in the last little while. In fact, earlier today, I was reading a story about a young man, I think only 12 or 13 years old, who was gunned down by police officers in a different state. Of course, the unfortunate and tragic killing of Trayvon Martin in Florida, And there are dozens of other examples, some of which have happened as recently as a few months ago. So that obviously is a huge factor to this. And from a social justice perspective, trying to unravel that and make sense of that discrepancy is, you know, impossible. It's difficult. There's really no answer to it. It's just this ongoing pattern, this horrible destructive pattern. Now, if we move beyond that for a moment, there are so many other ways to look at this. There is the sort of meta-analysis, looking at the way that this has been covered in the media. CNN particularly has come under fire for the rather explosive and some would argue exploitive nature of the way that they're covering this. The way that the rioting has been portrayed in the media, it's almost exclusively been portrayed as rioting, looting, civil disobedience, and very, very little coverage has gone into the peaceful side of the protest, the peaceful demonstrations, the marching, and that whole section has been suppressed. And what's being reported on is the crazy violence, the looting, showing this the dark side of civil protest and the dark side of all this frustration and anger created by this context of racism and discrimination and oppression. And to get back on the subject of the testimony of the police officer in question, you know, there's been a lot written about whether or not it's true or whether or not it's far-fetched or unbelievable. And what is shockingly ironic about this, of course, is that had this gone to trial, those answers could have been presented. Through cross-examination, through research, through lawyers and policymakers going over this, we could have gotten a clearer picture of what happened and why it happened. You know, there's obviously elements about the testimony of Wilson in question which are far-fetched, that are hard to understand. And it doesn't exactly sync up with the limited facts that we have. At the same time, clearly there was some altercation, and clearly that the man in question, Michael Brown, clearly that there was a altercation of some form between him and the police officer. And the notion, of course, that he had just robbed a convenience store, that he may have been taking marijuana or something, all of this has left questions in the air. Why did he behave in an aggressive manner? I mean, if he had marijuana in his system, wouldn't that make him, you know, not aggressive? Why did he try to assault a police officer who was armed? Why did the police officer propose the solution that he felt was needed? Why did he shoot him? Why didn't he tase him? Why didn't he mace him? You know, there's so many questions like that that simply won't get answered now because there won't go to trial. There won't be any opportunity to bring these questions up and find answers. And that, of course, is all the more mind-boggling with regards to the grand jury and their decision that essentially, despite all of those questions, they are satisfied that nothing potentially criminal has happened, that there is no reason to even consider the idea that the police officer in question, Wilson, acted improperly. And that's left so many people just shaking their head. And of course, it's erupted into this violence and this aggression in Ferguson alongside all of the legitimate peaceful protests. It's really caused just an incredible display of frustration and anger. And again, how can you even begin to tease apart this and understand what's going on? And indeed, you know, at this stage, what's the solution? How do we even come close to fixing this problem? Again, that's something that, you know, I won't be able to solve on this show, but I do want to mention it. And I just, you know, open the conversation. If anyone has any strong feelings on this, we'd love to hear from you.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow. It sure does pay to be a friend of CI. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to .cita. Keep smiling, keep shining, for when you can always count on me.
That's what friends are for.
We are the Jocelyn Pettit Band, and you're listening to our 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we are back here on The Sector, discussing the recent turmoil in Ferguson, Missouri. Now, before we move on from this topic, there was one other thing that I wanted to mention. And I sort of talked about this a bit earlier on with the notion of how the civil unrest is being reported. I mentioned how places like CNN, Fox News, etc., have, from almost the get-go, been referring to this as rioting, or looting, or some other word to describe it in terms of violence or disobedience. There's been very little coverage of it from the point of view of marches or peaceful protests, or even just demonstrations, or other kinds of disobedience that doesn't come across as overly hostile. Anyway, this line of reasoning has led some people to examine some of the ways that rioting is reported, and also, what are some of the motivations and causes of riots in North America, around the world, etc. So, a few people, I think there was a handful on Twitter, and then a few other social media sites sort of picked it up, like BuzzFeed and whatnot, suggesting these are the things that white people riot over. And I mean, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, and I think there's some biting sarcasm there, which is valid and really useful. So I just wanted to kind of go over a few of these points and just, you know, we can throw out there as talking points. Are these causes, of course? Well, one of the big ones is sports-related. So either a sports team wins or a sports team loses. Now, a good example of a sports team losing and resulting in a riot would be here in Vancouver, when the Vancouver Canucks lost the Stanley Cup Finals both to New York Rangers in the 1994 riots, and the more recent riots when they lost to the Boston Bruins. And that still stings. But anyway, what about when a sports team wins? So for instance, when San Francisco's baseball team won the championship, they rioted in the streets. So wins, losses, sports, I don't know, it just brings up the frustrations. Our example might be when a coach leaves a sports team for another team, which was demonstrated in Tennessee when I believe college football coach went to coach a different team. Or such big events like Black Friday, lack of beer sales, no Cabbage Patch dolls. Sure, we can all think about those Christmas Eves where desperate parents storm a toy store and trample everybody trying to get the latest It toy. Or here's one that's particularly shocking. The Penn State riot, which was students reacting to the firing of Joe Paterno. Of course, he was involved in the sex abuse scandal that rocked the university a number of years ago. Yeah, that generated rioting from the mostly white student base. So you have to kind of wonder here, like, why are the rioting, the civil disobedience, why is all of this that's happening in Ferguson, why is the refrain for them that they need to calm down and start thinking rationally and violence goes nowhere? And yet, why weren't the rioters, when it came to, you know, sports teams or the Penn State or Black Friday or anything like that, why wasn't the conversation focused on calming down and stop being looters and blah, blah, blah? Why was there such a different way of presenting those riots compared to the way that the riots in Ferguson are being presented. And it's something to think about. It's something to think about how the media can change the narrative of an event, how we can put on different biases and get this strange view of an event that's not really representative of how it's actually happening. So again, something to think about, something to give some deep thought, and perhaps keep a bit skeptical of the way the media is portraying the events in Ferguson. As more happens and more insights come available, we will discuss them and bring them up here on the show. And again, if you have any thoughts about this, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com, and we would love to hear from you. Now, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some more civil unrest and perhaps civil disobedience, depending on how you want to look at it. This is a bit more local here in the Vancouver area in Burnaby, where protesters have been raising the alarm over the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain pipeline, which is potentially going to be built and will transport oil resources, etc., between Edmonton, Alberta, and Burnaby, which is east of Vancouver. There's a lot of frustration about this project, and a lot of the protests have been motivated by different sectors across Canada. So, for example, you have the traditional environmental groups who are lobbying against this, and indeed, the danger from a leak or a rupture seems to be somewhat underreported. There's also the issue of the economic benefits being either overstated or completely absent of the communities that these pipelines are being built through. So Burnaby or any of the other communities where this is being constructed are not really going to see any benefits at all from this construction. So it's not like they're going to reap any kind of reward from building this giant pipeline. Additionally, you have the concerns of First Nation groups who, I mean, of course, have a very long list and a very good reason, good reasons for being skeptical of big companies, big corporations coming in, going into their land and taking resources out in a messy and wasteful extraction process. Obviously, you know, history gives us a pretty good understanding of that. And then additionally, there is a lot of concern from public policy in that the companies in question, for example, Kinder Morgan, is actually kind of circumventing democracy and waging a lot of propaganda wars, strong-arming the legal system, and, you know, kind of greasing the wheels to get their way. Now, that's all, you know, speculation and whatnot, but it does raise very concerning questions about whether or not this process is actually taking place with the respect and the autonomy of the public, or is it being forced down the public's throat by a, you know, powerful company with, you know, ambivalent overseeing government. It's hard to say. Now, what's going on, of course, right now is that there's lots of protests going on Burnaby Mountain, concerned about this. And I thought we should give it a bit of coverage here on the sector. And just, again, to kind of relate it back to Ferguson and talk about the importance of civil unrest and what that can do and how that can change society and change the direction of things. Now, to give a bit of background on the circumstances, you have Kinder Morgan, and they're trying to build this Trans Mountain pipeline. Now, since about December of last year, there's been ongoing consultations, energy board meetings, applications, a lot of like legal mumbo-jumbo to try to get access to Burnaby Mountain. All of that came to a head when the when Kinder Morgan applied to the courts to get permission to start building their facilities without the consent of Burnaby. And they were actually granted access without consent on August 19th of 2014. And of course, this allowed Kinder Morgan to basically block off sections of Burnaby, keeping out city officials, staff, etc. I mean, just a tremendous violation of the city's autonomy, as well as a huge violation of the right to assembly. It's ridiculous. Following that, the Trans Mountain project started diverting traffic, obstructing roads. Again, all of this sort of thing the city of Burnaby was arguing was contravened by the bylaws and also, you know, detrimental to quality of life in Burnaby. The city of Burnaby issued orders to cease bylaw contraventions, but it doesn't seem like that's going anywhere at all. So after more legal challenges and attempts to file applications for appeals by the city of Burnaby and for environmentalists trying to prevent this, ultimately all coming to a failure, protesters took to Burnaby Mountain as a way to block the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Recently, as about November 17th, the RCMP started enforcing these court orders to keep people off of Burnaby Mountain and started arresting protesters. And you can see lots of photos of this on Twitter. You can see there's some blog posts that have been written about this, and I'll post a few to the show notes as well. Recently, environmentalist David Suzuki delivered a speech at Burnaby Mountain to the RCMP, and protests expanded at the Port of Seattle in solidarity with Burnaby Mountain protesters, as well as with many of the First Nation groups who are speaking at the event. Since November 21st, over 60 protesters have been arrested, including an SFU molecular biologist and David Suzuki's grandson. So the protests are continuing, and they have on their side the city of Burnaby, who is opposing this. Burnaby's mayor recently won re-election, so that, I think, is a demonstration of the city's will against Kinder Morgan. Now, where this is going to go is remains to be seen. Of course, there's been a lot of questions as to why exactly the RCMP are diverting so much resources to basically prevent and arrest peaceful protesters from entering Kinder Morgan's injunction zone, this kind of forbidden territory that protesters must not access. And it gives rise to a lot of, I think, very telling questions. You know, how is it possible that a corporation has such power, such influence, that they can circumvent the Canadian rights about assembly and protest and civil disobedience? How is it that this company has the ability to circumvent the right of Canadians to attempt to make social change through action? I mean, it's mind-boggling, isn't it? Another, I mean, ironic in a certain way, but also kind of horrible sense, is that the RCMP are not subject to the city of Burnaby. They're not the city of Burnaby's police force. They are their own separate, federally controlled police force. So it's not like the mayor could even order the RCMP out of Burnaby Mountain, because they're not responsible to the mayor of Burnaby. They're not like the VPD, the Vancouver Police Department, who does have to obey orders from the city. So it's that whole aspect of it is also really kind of, you almost kind of have to wonder, was that planned? Did they know about that, Kinder Morgan, when they said, let's build in Burnaby where there's very little resources for the city to oppose us? It's just kind of creepy. And another aspect of this that recently came to light, as I was reading in an article on the CBC, the BC Civil Liberties Association is saying that it's quite likely that the RCMP may have actually arrested people without cause, because many of the protesters were not actually in the Kinder Morgan no-go zone. And they're pointing to a court document that the Kinder Morgan has applied for to expand their injunction area. Now, basically what this means is that people were being arrested for standing next to the injunction area, not inside the injunction area. It may seem like a semantic little thing, but in a court of law, that's the whole point. You have to obey the letter of law. So, you know, what effect this is going to have on the situation remains unclear. But, I mean, it's a pretty telling example of how, you know, the RCMP and Kinder Morgan kind of are looking at the situation in sort of a, well, okay, so we don't have 100% coverage, let's just go back to the course and get it expanded a few feet. You know, it's there's very little interest in dialogue or finding a common ground for a solution. It's all about, you know, how far can we push the courts to get our way here? Well, we're going to keep our eye on the Burnaby protests, and we'll hopefully try to have some more coverage in the future. Maybe get an interview with one of the protesters, or perhaps one of the people who are involved with organizing it. And we'll get more answers, and we will keep track of this development of social justice and activism. So we'll take a quick break here on the show. Coming up later on, we have some information on donating and the motivating factors for giving in the holiday season. What do you think those factors might be? Now, this is going to be interesting. We'll have a bit of a look at, are you more likely to donate if your friends publicize their donation through social media, Facebook, Twitter? If somebody posts that, I just gave $25 to the food bank, do you think that's going to make you more or less likely to donate? We'll examine the research in a little bit. We'll also discuss, what do you think Canadian employees prefer for a holiday gift? Do you think they would rather have a nice big holiday basket with, you know, cheese and crackers and chocolate? Or do you think a company could score more points with their employees by giving to charity? So we'll look at that idea, and we'll see where charitable giving is going in the holiday season. So stay tuned for that. Before going to break, however, let's have another musical interlude. So I'm going to play a song by Interpol, the American rock band. They recently put out a new album, which is fantastic because they haven't put out one in a pretty long time. So exciting. Yay. This is the song All the Rage Back Home. And it's off their new album, El Pintor, which is Spanish for painter, I believe. And so take a listen, and we'll go to a commercial after the song and back on the sector after this.
You don't need time, you need shame. You won't need your mate inside. on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest, placing images of Black taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the...
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind. Can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. For instance, I'm walking along. And I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism right here on our home on CITR. And, of course, we just played, before the break, that was All the Rage Back Home by Interpol off their new album El Pintor. So great indie rock there. If you're into that, check it out. One of my favorite bands. I love taking a little bit of a break and playing just a bit of music here on The Sector. Kind of livens things up a little bit. We were getting a bit heavy with social activism, social disobedience, if you'll have it, civil disobedience, civil unrest. Discussing what was going on in Ferguson, Missouri. Of course, the riots, the protesting going on there, as well as the protesting that was going on Burnaby Mountain, in opposition to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So we're going to keep those two stories active here on The Sector. We'll touch in with them every now and then to see what's going on and if there's any new insights that we can gain from that. Of course, we invite your feedback. Please let us know what you think at sectorpodcast@gmail.com and visit us at sectorpodcast@wordpress.com and feel free to contact us on Twitter or Facebook at sectorpodcast. Or at Ethan Clow, and Facebook is an option for you as well. Well, before the break, I teased about the new research going into holiday giving, and this is always fun. Giving around the holidays is sort of it's kind of the time of year where you always give money. Fundraisers, for them, you know, it's literally Christmas. Get it? Because Christmas happens at the holidays, and So the point being is this is the time of year when nonprofits and charities really pull out all the stops. They go to every length they can. It's the time of year when they draw in the most in terms of funding. And in fact, the holiday appeals pretty much make up the bulk of a nonprofit's operating costs. So for any charity out there, they'll be sending out direct mail. And of course, we looked at a few direct mail options in the past couple of weeks. They will do phone calls. They will reach out to donors every way that they can. They may have a big gala. They may have a big event that they encourage you to come by. They'll have tickets at the door and then like a donation, maybe a raffle. Now, some charities, of course, have tried to branch out a little bit and to sort of experiment with where they can best place themselves. The holiday season from about the end of November, so right about now till about the end of the year, is kind of that big zone where all the major charities try to get their appeals out. So some charities have thought, well, can we really compete with the children's hospitals of the world, with the Union Gospels of the world? Can we really compete with the food banks of the world? Should we try to maybe position ourselves a bit before, or maybe a bit after? So you actually kind of get more of a winter appeal in some cases. Nonprofits will be reaching out as early as September and even as late as February. I know that in my own experience, I've worked with nonprofits that have done their winter appeal quite late all in the season. So, I mean, we're talking about like February, March, even April. So that's a pretty big leap from just, you know, the Christmas time season. Partly that can be dependent on the charity itself. So for like a university where they're appealing to alumni, right around the time when the semesters start up and end is very good for them. If you're targeting an alumni who perhaps is married and has kids, you know, there's a good chance that those are the times when those kids will be going to that university. So, you know, you call up Mr. Smith and you're like, Mr. Smith, I understand that you went to, let's say, UBC. And now I understand that your kids are coming to UBC, and that's a great time to consider becoming a donor for the Alumni Association and blah, blah, blah. You know, they give you a pitch and an appeal as to why now's a great time to, you know, open up your wallet. And the great thing about the holidays, of course, is that people are primed to open up their wallet. Right now, Black Friday is happening in the States, which is the frenzy for buying things. Everything has been discounted. So people are just coming back from, you know, buying new TVs and game systems and all kinds of fancy stuff. And there's always that kind of like a little bit of like, you know, guilt and selfishness about you going out and buying all this stuff, spending all this money. And along comes a charity that says, hey, could you throw a little our way, you know, 20 bucks, 50 bucks. And it's like a great way to sort of push off that guilt and, you know, absolve yourself. And so you put a few bucks their way. And, you know, that's a really great way for the charity sector to kind of like, I don't know, sort of like nudge us a little bit towards social giving. But it kind of depends. I mean, some people it doesn't work on at all. Other people, you know, they give all year round, so it's not a huge issue for them. I don't know. What do you think? Do you feel with all the Christmas shopping or, you know, Hanukkah shopping or Festivus shopping that you do, do you feel slightly more inclined to give to charity around this time of year? With all the sales, Black Friday, Boxing Day, do you feel a little bit that the materialism of today's age has perhaps left you a bit jaded? And do you feel that maybe by giving to charity, you kind of push that away a little bit? You deal with a bit of the guilt associated with buying all these nice things by giving to those who don't have all that much to begin with? I don't know. It's a good question, right? So what's interesting about this, of course, is for the average person, me or you or our friends, when we give to charity and we share that information, which actually I believe we need to do more of, we need to talk more about how we give to charity. But the question, of course, is how can that motivate others to give? And what is the best method of motivating others to give? Well, the American Red Cross did a survey that found that among social media users, it's actually the message and not the medium that's key to motivating social media users to donate to charity. So for instance, what this suggests is that a trending topic or a gimmick like the Ice Bucket Challenge or, you know, like direct mail could actually kind of could fall into this category a little bit, but on a social media scale. So, you know, taking a photo with your donation or that kind of thing, those may not be all that effective compared to the effectiveness of sort of the peer pressure and the social media pressure that is generated by the message itself. So, for instance, if I say that I donated 50 bucks to charity and I post it on Facebook or Twitter, just that message alone might be more effective in convincing others to donate than the charity itself creating a very slick social media campaign. So the study conducted by the Red Cross found that social users are a charitable group overall, with more than 71% donating to charity in the past 12 months. And those who gave to charity, 60% donated online. Now, the online survey was about included about 1,021 adults conducted between October 16th and 19th, and found that in the online space, a personal connection was more important when deciding to give to charity. The majority, 70% of social media users, would take some kind of action in response to a friend posting a story on social media about making a charitable donation. So what's interesting about this is that about 3% said that social media was an effective way for the charity to request a donation. But that number jumped up to 19% when asked if they would donate to a charity if they saw a friend post about a recent donation. To quote from the study, "This survey shows how social networks and charitable giving are intersecting and building on one another," from Gail McGovern, president and CEO of the Red Cross. Quote, "These social philanthropists are giving online to charities and sharing the news on social networks, which then often leads to more social activity and more giving by their friends. I believe this trend will only grow in the future," end quote. So that's an interesting way of looking at things. And it's also interesting because, you know, like, why? Why is that happening? Like, is it jealousy? Is it guilt? Is it... do people see the happiness that their friends have from giving, and do they feel that, like, how is that motivating them? What is that cause? We don't really get the answer to that in the research, but it's still very, very fascinating. And, like, why is this happening? What's also interesting is the effect of, like, a social media campaign by a charity. Most users and donors said that, you know, they're really unaffected or uninterested by trends or gimmicks or the outreach itself from the charity. They're far more interested in the personal story that a friend or a colleague or someone they know will share, and that is far more motivating for them to make a donation. Which, of course, leads to some very interesting ideas for a nonprofit or a charity. Instead of, like, focusing on a slick marketing campaign, find a way to motivate your donors to share stories, to share a personal connection to the charity. Find out why somebody is giving to you and encourage them to share that story, share that experience with social media. That is going to have way more impact on people than, you know, merely saying, you know, it's the season of giving or whatever, and that's going to have a stronger appeal. Now, shifting gears a little bit, one of the things that I mentioned earlier was this notion of employee giving, and we've actually kind of talked about this in the past on the sector, but there's been a recent poll that I think is relevant and also kind of ties into the whole charitable giving at this time of year thing. Now, you might think that employees really appreciate a show of appreciation from their employer around this time of year. You know, a gift basket or some kind of holiday bonus. But where things are a bit surprising is that a recent poll by Ipsos Reid found that 73% of Canadians would actually prefer their employer to give a gift to charity instead of them. And that they would actually prefer that charitable gift be done maybe in their name or whatever. But it's if the employer knows a bit about the employee, if they know a bit about their interests, their values, and their tastes, that if the organization could make a gift that reflected those, they would much rather prefer that than, you know, a gift basket or a gift certificate or whatever, one of those, you know, cheesy presents that you get from your employer. So the poll findings are quite interesting. 59% of Canadians would prefer that companies they deal with give a charitable gift. 78% of Canadians prefer that the gift helps somebody in need. 59% indicated that they would likely to give a charitable gift this holiday season, you know, as well as their employer. And 75% of Canadians agree that during the holiday season, they think more about those less fortunate. So you have a kind of a perfect storm here. A smart employer could get a lot of brownie points with their own employees if they had a system in place to say, understand which charities or causes the employee values. So, you know, maybe they send out a questionnaire or they take the time, get to know that employee, figure out what their giving habits are, where their interests and values lay, and then coming up with a system. So, for example, an employer could say, okay, well, look, we know that you love giving to food banks. You think that that's a really important thing. So we're going to create a system where instead of giving you a gift basket, we're going to give $100 to the local food bank in your name. And there's also an opportunity where you can add to that if you like. So if you want to say add $50, $25, or even $100, we're going to make that possible. So not only are the employees, they feel happy that their values are being respected, they feel happy that the organization is giving to charity, and they feel happy that they're invited to take part in the gift so that they can sort of maximize their holiday giving. It's a really nice gesture, and I think it's something that could really catch on with Canadian workers. And it's interesting too, of course, that of the Canadians who give a charitable gift, 50% do so at Christmas time. So that's more than any other time of year. And it does kind of factor into this whole spirit of generosity at this time of year. So again, if you're an employer and you're looking for an opportunity to give a gift to your employees, maybe is a good time to, you know, instead of spending money on a gift basket or, you know, a Tim Hortons gift card, make a donation. Make a donation in their name and have an opportunity for them to, you know, chip into that, and you could really score some points. Well, we are running out of time on yet another episode of The Sector. This has been episode 29 of The Sector. Excellent. Well done. Almost at episode 30. And getting close to the holidays, so, you know, get those checkbooks out, make a donation. Anyway, let's go to a quick commercial break here on the show. We'll come back after this and wrap things up.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, wrapping things up for episode 29. This has been our episode discussing the civil unrest going on in North America, of course, in Ferguson, as well as in Burnaby, with a bit of a nonprofit charity tagline at the end there for some donations. And of course, with the holiday season upon us, I do encourage you to consider making a donation, whether it's direct mail or otherwise. On future episodes of The Sector coming up, we are going to have with us some interviews later on. So maybe towards the end of December or a bit before, depending on how things go. We will keep in mind the events that are happening in Ferguson and Burnaby Mountain. So if you have any news stories or links that you want us to talk about, feel free to send them to us. We will take a look. And of course, once again, to contact us, that is sectorpodcast sectorpodcast@gmail.com and find the show notes and podcast available at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, where you can subscribe and, of course, get information on where to listen. Listen live at citr.ca and, of course, on the radio Fridays, 8 a.m. So we will, of course, be back next week, barring any technical issues, but I'm sure that won't happen. And so stay tuned. You'll see us next week. In the meantime, let's on the show, and see you all next week. Happy gaming.